one pill makes you small, and the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall. And if you go chasing rabbits,
well, the young Turks. Interesting show ahead for you guys. I'm excited about, of course, a lot of things. Most of all, we're going to get Simon Johnson on today, former chief economist at the IMF and current professor at MIT, and one of the guys who understands the need for financial reform better than almost anyone else in the country. And he's talked about the intellectual capture and otherwise, economic capture, et cetera, of the United States government by some of the largest banks and richest people in the country. And so, and he says it reminds him of his days at the IMF when countries like Russia would be captured, the government would be captured by oligopolies and the people who run them. So it's a fascinating discussion. That's going to happen a little later in the program. Now, you know, we have stories about the madness of Republicans today. What's the three themes, right? Madness of Republicans, the sellout of Democrats, that's also happening today, trust me, coming up very soon, okay, over and over again, and the total uselessness of the media. I don't know if we're doing that today, but we'll see if we get to it, okay? All right, so let's start with a new controversy. We have the N word. Everybody knows what that is. And then we added the F word to that. And some people are still confused about that because they're like, what, you mean the F with the thing and the sex? No, the F referring to gays, right? So no, that's out. Okay, so that's the F word. And apparently we're adding a new thing to our lexicon now, the R word. The R word cannot be said. Anybody know what it is? Anybody? Anybody? JR, can you take a guess? R as in ridiculous? No, of course not. Nothing, right? Okay, I'm going to say it for the last time now, only for the purpose of edification, because I don't think anyone knows what it is. And then from then on, I will be banned from saying it as part of political correctness. Retarded. Okay? The word is retarded. Okay, it is not. That's it! Officially banned. From now on, we denounce and reject anyone who uses it. Why is this a controversy now? Because Rahm Emanuel used it as a slur against liberals. Now, mind you, Rahm Emanuel is supposed to be liberal. In fact, he's the chief of staff to President Obama, who Fox News calls every day a socialist, Marxist, Maoist, uber-left progressive, right? The reality is, of course, is that Rahm Emanuel is nowhere near liberal. In fact, he called liberals in a meeting effing retarded. Okay. All right. Already we have a violation. I denounce and reject myself. Okay. I meant the R word. So, who's all over him for this, and why is he in trouble? Because I was all over him for this, and the Wall Street Journal even wrote an article about it, saying, you know, Rahm Emanuel does not represent progressive interest, etc. But why is he in actual trouble? Because progressives in this country can't get anybody in trouble, can't get anybody's attention. Nobody pays attention to them. So, no, it's Sarah Palin. She's on the warpath. And she says that he is being unbelievably insensitive, indecent, and should immediately be fired. So every media organization in the country has written a story about it today. No matter where I went, you know, I turned CBS News, oh, Sarah Palin story, Associated Press, Yahoo, wherever you go, that's it. Okay, so let me read you a part of her statement. Of course, she writes it in Facebook. Look, she's all new media. I can respect that. I'm always a little amused by grown-ass politicians doing that, but that's all right. God bless. I'm in favor. She says, are you capable of decency, Rahm Emanuel? Quote, just as we'd be appalled if any public figure of Rahm's stature ever used the N-word or other such inappropriate language. Rahm's slur on all God's children with cognitive and development disabilities, and the people who love them, is unacceptable, and it's heartbreaking. Can I say that that statement is the R word? Or that's going. Now, the slur was used against us, okay? I mean, he almost specifically meant liberals who are attacking him. Me, okay? Now, do I think Rahm Emanuel hates children with Down syndrome, and he was obviously trying to use a slur against them or, you know, somehow reference us? Now, he was just calling us stupid. You know, if you say that word is offensive and let's not use it anymore, okay, all right, you know, obviously some people are greatly offended by it. I get it, and look, that's an interesting conversation, okay? But you're not going to fire Rahm Emanuel over that. That's crazy. That's nonsense, okay? So, nobody even knew until yesterday that that word was illegal, okay? Or that word was unacceptable. Now, that's not fair. Some people have been on the warpath against that word, saying it's a bad word and shouldn't be used, okay? But was it a firing offense for anybody who used it? I think that's going to be news to a lot of Americans. I mean, Sarah Palin is so stupid. Can I use that word? Can I use the S word? Or is that an offense against all of God's children who are a little deficient in the mental categories? Okay. She's so stupid that she's made me defend Rahm Emanuel. Okay. I don't like Rahm Emanuel. I don't like any part of Rahm Emanuel. But this is absurd. So, and wouldn't it be ironic if this is why Rahm Emanuel got fired? Not for selling out the corporate America, not for selling out health insurance, not for political bungling and losing Kennedy's seat when he's supposed to be a political genius, not for not getting health care reform passed at all, not for any of those substantive stuff. But Sarah Palin was offended because he used the R word. He's a goner. But you know what? I wouldn't be surprised, because the progressives will apparently never be listened to in the country, but conservatives, I mean, any absurd claim, it doesn't matter. And everybody has to stop what they're doing and listen and cave. And, of course, Democrats eventually cave in, crumble to them. So maybe I should thank Sarah Palin. I should thank her for the favor she's doing us. Getting rid of Rahm Emanuel might be a great blessing in disguise. Well, it's not even in disguise. It's very obvious to me. By the way, at the end of the Yahoo story on it, they say, you know, Rahm Emanuel is, and this was in all the stories, this first part, has apologized to, you got to find someone to apologize to, right? When you use the N-word, you go apologize to the head of the NAACP and randomly Al Sharpton, right? Because he's in the press a lot. So who do you apologize to if you use the R-word? This, God, I love political correctness. I find it so amusing. And the ironic thing is people accuse us of political correctness. You kidding me, man? You watch this show? All right. Apparently, you were supposed to apologize to Special Olympics Chairman, CEO Tim Shriver. He is now the guru and the end-all, be-all decider of who can and cannot use the R-word and whether they should be fired. So Rahm Emanuel, hat in hand, went to him and, of course, apologized profusely. And the apology apparently was accepted. You are pardoned. Okay. But at the end of the Yahoo article, they said, ironically, the one group that Rahm Emanuel did not apologize to and says he will never apologize to is the people he called the R-word, liberals. So liberal groups fighting for progressive priorities. You think you're going to get an apology? Shut up! I'm busy kowtowing to Sarah Palin and randomly the CEO of the Special Olympics. You know your place. You know what you are. You're the R-word. Oh, by the way, political genius Rahm Emanuel, who's now going around apologizing to half the people in the world, what happened? I thought we were the R-word. I thought you were the really smart one. How'd you get yourself in trouble like this? Weird. Maybe not a political genius after all. I'm going to have to put some thought behind that. All right, so that's the nonsense Sarah Palin story of the day. Now let me give you a little bit of substance, okay? Let me get worked up. all right, let's roll up the sleeves. So, I've been in a bit of a controversy today with Senator Dodd's office, okay? I wrote a blog this morning talking about how bipartisanship is a fraud, a scam, a political cover for the Democrats to sell out to corporate America. If you watch the show, you've heard me talk about that a lot. I wrote about it, and I said, I think the main takeaway from that article and what's a little more newer than what I've been talking about in the past is, and I've said it before, but I want to emphasize it today, which is, look, why has there never been calls for bipartisanship when the Republicans are in charge? Not never, but very rarely. And certainly the Republicans don't give a damn, right? So when Bush and Cheney were in charge, nobody talked about bipartisanship. You talked about kicking Democratic ass and shoving things down their throats, right? Was there like a big call? Oh, we're going to have tax cuts. Oh, we don't want to filibuster. Let's get bipartisanship. Put Democrats, please, 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 we vote for tax cuts. No, they just shut the hell up and take the tax cuts and put them wherever the hell you like in your body part, okay? But they're coming, whether you like it or not. No talk of bipartisanship. Now, why? All of a sudden, the Democrats switch over, bipartisan, 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 bipartisan. What happened? What changed, right? Now, one could make the argument that the Democrats are nicer or more reasonable or more moderate. One could make that argument if they were politically naive. Okay, here's the reality. The Republicans don't need political cover. Everybody knows they're for the rich and the powerful, okay? That's how they, that's their go-to move. They collect money from the rich and the powerful, and then they turn around, and look, don't get me wrong, of course, they try to trick the people who vote for them by saying, oh, we're for freedom and liberty, yeah, we're on your side, but I mean, so it's an obvious fraud, everybody knows, right? Anyone who's paying attention, the 33% who vote for them no matter what, all you have to say is the magic word, God. Oh, God's on the Republican side, okay, which banker do you need me to subsidize, right? So that game is obvious. Man, the Democrats, though, they got a problem. The problem is they pretend to be on our side, right? But I don't mean liberals or progressives. I mean the people. They pretend to stand up for consumers and taxpayers, et cetera, and they're standing up to the powerful, and they're going to bring you change, and you should have hope. Now, that's a real problem for the Democrats because they take more money from lobbyists than even the Republicans do. So now how are they going to continue to get that lobbyist cash so they could overpower anybody in their local elections with the lobbyist cash that they raise and their opponents cannot raise since they're not in power? So how are they going to get that lobbyist money while pretending to do reform? Well, two things. One, all of a sudden, they're going to have this love of bipartisanship. And then when you look at that, the Republicans won't go along. Oh, you twisted my arm. Oh, no, oh, they won't. You won't go along. All right, let's water down the bill. All right, make the check payable to Senator Chris Dodd, right? So they use the Republicans as cover to do so-called compromises, to be centrists and moderates and get bipartisan deals. Now, have the American people in the last 10 years or so, 20 years, you can go back further, I'm sure there was a time when there was real bipartisanship, okay? In fact, a lot of people would point to 1978 as when it started to get much worse because of changes in financing of the Democratic Party, et cetera. Okay, that's another long story. So, but since then, has a bipartisan deal ever helped the American people? I mean, let's look at the recent past. So they strike bipartisan deals in the Senate for health care. What happened? Public option, gone. So you no longer have that option. It was supported by 60 to 80% of the American people in over a dozen polls. It's too bad for you. Not supported by the lobbyists. So we have a moderate compromise for bipartisanship, and look at that, the thing that the people are in favor of is gone, and the private insurance companies are protected. Shocking. Medicare buy-in, gone, would help the American people, would help the deficit. Conservatives claim to care about the deficit. Drug reimportation would save us $100 billion over the next 10 years, gone. Bipartisanship, they kill it so that they can continue to take big pharma money. The drug companies give more money than almost anyone else to the politicians, okay? And accordingly, also the fourth thing gone among many, many things is negotiating with drug companies. Now, of course the government should be able to negotiate with drug companies. No right-minded American would say no to that. I don't even think the R-word teabaggers would disagree with that. Then why wouldn't we want to negotiate with drug companies? Of course we would, right? Well, that's also gone. Why? Bipartisanship. They decided to make a deal, the Republicans and the Democrats, where, shockingly enough, look at that, the corporate lobbyists won and you lost yet again. Huh, funny how that bipartisanship works. And now, look, now we get to the media side of it. The media is pathetic. Instead of telling you what bipartisanship really is, which is a wholesale capitulation to corporate lobbyists, nobody, the American public have, they have not worked at all in any bipartisan conference. Look, I'm going to give you more examples. Finance. We're doing financial reform now. Chris Dodd, and that's why he's involved in this story, came out with really strong rules in the beginning in the Senate side and said, look, these are the financial reform we need. I came on the show and said, wow, fantastic. I'm in favor of it, right? And what happened since then? Say it with me. Bipartisan compromise. So all of a sudden, not as much financial reform. All of a sudden, we're not separating the banks, according to the latest negotiations in the Senate, of commercial banks and investment banks, which means that they can continue to gamble with your money. You know, are we going to cap leverage and capital requirements? Well, maybe, maybe not. Are we going to, you know, look at derivatives? As you look up and down the list, every single so-called compromise here to the Republicans has been to water down the bill, make it weaker, and make financial reform much less effective and much more in favor of the banks. Gee, I wonder how that happened. Well, yeah. So in between conservative and liberal, I guess in the middle is corporate. That's not the middle between conservative and liberal. It's a guise. So the Democrats love that they have, that they can be filibustered by the Republicans, because it allows them to go, the Republicans, oh, we need 60 votes. Okay, lobbyists, come on, I give in. Everything you want. And it's, bipartisanship, we need all, bipartisanship. What do I say? Where do I get the check? Come on. Okay, that's the game that's being played. So, well, what's my beef with Senator Dodd's office? So I write this blog and I talk about Senator Dodd. As I mentioned on the show yesterday, there was a quote from a staffer of his in the Financial Times saying, Senator Dodd, is about to retire, and so above all else, he wants bipartisanship. In fact, they said it twice in the quote, which I translated to mean Senator Dodd is retiring. He'd like a really nice fat paycheck from the banks when he retires. So under the guise of bipartisanship, he will make this bill much, much weaker, which he's in the process of doing now. So Senator Dodd's office reaches out to me after the article goes up, and they say that it was grossly unfair of me because that was Financial Times quoting a staffer. It was not an official statement. And to be fair, in the article originally I said it was a statement from the office, and that was incorrect. So now the attribution was wrong there, so I fixed that. Is the substance right? Come on. So then they give me an official statement about, no, you don't understand. Senator Dodd is working so hard for the Volcker rule. That's the tough rule that Obama's now pushing, okay? And he's, you know, look at his statements. They sent me a statement of Senator Dodd saying he's strongly in favor of the Volcker rule. Oh, well, then that probably settles it. Look, save me your crocodile tears, okay? You want to prove to me Senator Dodd's in favor of strong reform? There's a pretty easy way to do it. He's the head of the committee. He could pass strong reform. And if he does, you win. I'll come on air. You know me. I'll come on air instantly and be like, Senator Dodd rocks. He kicks ass. I was so wrong to ever question him. I mean, he passed real reform. And he didn't cave into special interests and lobbyists under the guise of working with the Republicans. He didn't do that at all. My bad. Now, how many of you out there think that's what's going to happen? That ain't going to happen. You know what they're doing right now, the Finance Committee? Instead of using their advantage, the Democrats have more people than the Republicans, significantly more in the Senate, obviously, and they could, and hence they have more people in the Finance Committee. No, just like they did for health care reform, they have eliminated that advantage for themselves, and they're negotiating on an even basis, 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, broken up to groups of 5, one-on-one negotiation. Do you remember the Republicans giving up their advantage in the Senate and saying, no, even though we have more senators, will give you equal power? Do you remember that? I don't remember that, right? So why are they doing that? Why would anybody voluntarily do that? Because they want to use the Republicans as an excuse to make sure that they water down the bill in the ways that the banks want so that they can cash in later. That's the reality of American politics, and that's why...
Sometimes... I feel discouraged. Yeah.
One more thing. JR sent me a great article on these reform efforts. And all the Republicans... So one encouraging side of that, actually, is that Obama is now pushing for reform that is tougher than the current version in the Senate. So look at this. Okay? Hey, credit where credit is due. I can't wait to give people credit. I just never get an opportunity, right? So Obama's fighting for more reform. Great. And he is pushing for the Volcker Rule. And for the moment being, it does not seem disingenuous. Okay? He is putting some pressure on the Democratic senators, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So that's positive news. So how did the Republicans react to that? They were, of course, outraged, livid, threatening, saying, oh, here, let me give you some quick quotes. Let's go to Senator Judd Gregg, who was supposed to be in the administration. He says that, I think it's confused the issue considerably, this Obama's new push for harder reform, because he's basically fanned the fires of populism. And in a lot of instances, populism doesn't give you either good regulatory activity or strong markets. It undermines both in many instances. I mean, the guy's pretty much telling you, I can't wait to screw over the little guy. I can't wait to do exactly what the bankers say, because that's the real correct regulatory practices. And I don't want to be blinded by what the people want. God forbid it's a democracy, right? So, and then there was Bob Corker, and I could quote you eight other Republicans who all said the same thing, screw the people, we want to protect the banks here, okay? Under the guise of this, tut, tut, tut. What President Obama is suggesting it sounds awfully populist, like he's in favor of the little people. Oh, come on. Which, for the first time in a long time, made me think, hey, look at that, Obama's doing something good. All right, so, what? But that's not the interesting part of the story. That's to be expected. What's the interesting part? The Democratic race. Almost every senator quoted, Senator Mark Warner, see if I have the other names here in front of me. I don't, okay? But Warner and some of the others. Bipartisanship. Of course! They said it three different times in the article. The Democrats, looking forward to bipartisanship, want to work with the Republicans, and they are worried that Obama's new tougher proposals endangers their bipartisan relationship with the Republicans and what they've been working on so far, and they're afraid that it might make reform harder, not easier. What it's making harder is them cashing the check from the lobbyist who said, look, I put your name on it, Mark Warner, and he's a Democrat from Virginia, but you can't cash it yet until you make sure that there's really no good reform, okay? One more thing. When I get worked up on this, you know. Okay. So one more thing. One of Obama's proposals is to go after the bonuses. Okay. So that has the CEOs livid. Now, normally they go through their PR people. They go through their lobbyists, etc. But this time, it's very specifically their ass on the line. They might not get to make $100 million a year in bonuses anymore. God forbid, maybe they would only take $20 or $50 million a year in bonuses. So the article explains that the CEOs, including Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan, flew down to Washington themselves, went door to door. They went and talked to all the senators on the Finance Committee. They talked to are you sitting? They talked to Tim Geithner. He took their call. It's really weird. He brought them right in to consult with him. They talked to Ben Bernanke. These names keep on surprising me, right? And Dimon goes personally to him, you better not touch my bonus, otherwise I will fuck this economy up. Just like I did before. You've been warned. I guess he's saying, if you threaten my paycheck, I'll threaten your paycheck. And that's how our government got captured. Simon Johnson will tell you more about it a little later in the program. Young Turks.
It is more about them than it is about the team. Cannot play with them. Cannot win with them. Cannot coach with them. Can't do it. Our formula is this. We go out, we hit people in the mouth. Number one. No. You know what? This is how I believe, okay? I'm from the old school.
God.
It will change. And it will change because they wanted to change. Not because of me.
Mike Singletary, man. Who doesn't love that guy? I hate the 49ers. Always hated the 49ers.
Our formula is this.
He's making me like them.
We go out, we hit people in the mouth. Number one.
There is a bomb in Gilead to make the wounded whole. There is a bomb in Gilead to heal the sin-sick soul.
All right, let's go back to the crooks. So, this guy has some nerve, man. Hank Paulson, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, the former Treasury chief who wound up giving an enormous bailout to Goldman Sachs, not in the form of the TARP money. Yes, he did that as well. But that was the cover for the backdoor bailout of $13 billion through AIG, which he personally engineered. Now he gets interviewed for his new book, On the Brink, Inside the Race to Stop the Collapse of the Global Financial System. Like somehow he rescued it. Please. What a piece of garbage that book is. So we're hoping to get him on the show to talk about it. Here's a quote that he had with a CNBC interviewer, which, of course, went after him really hard, because you know how tough the media is. The quote from Hank Paulson is, "What I say in the book is that when I ran with Goldman Sachs, even during benign times, I had felt the compensation in the industry seemed out of whack, and I would occasionally go off in the partners' meetings and say something to the effect of, I hope you guys all understand, and remind them, people don't like you, very few people do, okay? And he'd go off on them and say, this compensation is out of whack. And then he collected a $500 million paycheck. That didn't all come at once, but that's what he made from Goldman Sachs. I mean, the balls on this guy. Telling an interviewer, he was yelling at the other Goldman executives about, oh, there's too much compensation. It's out of whack. The American people don't like it. Then maybe you could have taken $400 million in compensation and given $100 million back? $300 million? $200 million? I mean, come on, man. And what's amazing is that, again, the media treats him like he's a genius. He's a saint. You remember that Newsweek article they did on him? King Henry? Ah, it was terrible. And I hate to say it. It was by a reporter that I generally like who's written other good pieces. But that was hideous. And it was, oh, King Henry knows! Hank Paulson's a genius! And he did this and he did that. We should all bow down to Hank Paulson because he knows exactly what he's doing. Trust your money in Hank Paulson. Yeah, we did. And out it flew. And it's gone now. Bartley in Hank Paulson's pocket. All right. Talking about Democrats and their problems. So let's go to whether it makes sense to contribute to Democrats. Ben Nelson is a guy who decided that he was going to vote against the public option. In fact, he was going to join a Republican filibuster of the public option, and that's what killed it in the Senate. And, of course, Medicare buy-in he wasn't going to do any of this stuff. But, of course, since he's in a close election, the Democratic National Committee continues to give him money. So if you give money to the DNC, where does it go? Well, not only does it theoretically and possibly go to Ben Nelson, it literally goes to Ben Nelson. We know. We have the numbers now. The DNC has spent $460,000 on ads helping Ben Nelson. Remember how he cried when the Progressive Change Campaign Committee ran, like, what was it, $50,000 in ads? Something along those lines. He was like, how could they? They better not run it against me. And, in fact, that's part of the reason that Rahm Emanuel came and called the liberals effing R-word. Okay? And said, you know, how dare you guys run ads against good Democrats like Ben Nelson? You're so stupid. You don't know what you're doing. So now gullible Democrats across the country have been giving money to the DNC. So it gets funneled to Ben Nelson. Now, look. You can make an argument that Ben Nelson is better than a Republican in Nebraska, la, 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 la. That's one thing, right? And I think that's a defensible argument. I don't necessarily agree with it, and I'm not saying you should run a Democrat in the general election against them. That's impractical and stupid, okay? But if you can run a Democrat against them in the primary, well, then we're having a conversation. But what they spent the money on is the egregious part. They spent it on $460,000 worth of ads where Ben Nelson explains how proud he is that he voted against the public option. and makes the Republican case for them, saying how the government is, you know, can't be trusted, and that's why he voted against any government option. You want the actual ad? We got it for you. Clip number two.
With all the distortions about health care reform, I want you to hear directly from me. Some oppose any change, others want a government takeover. But I listened to you and took a common sense approach to improve the bill. Now it lowers costs for families and small business, protects Medicare, finally guarantees coverage for pre-existing conditions, and reduces the deficit. And it's not run by the government. I'm Ben Nelson. I approve this message because I'm convinced this is right for Nebraska.
All right. Government takeover, that's the main Republican talking point. So he spent your money that you gave to the Democrats, he spent it on making an ad that buttresses the Republican talking point, the main Republican talking point. Oh, the Democrats are trying to do a government takeover. Is that how you want your money spent? You have to be F and R word to give to the DNC if they're going to spend it on ads like that, to use Rahm Emanuel's language. Okay? By the way, I listen to you. Total and utter lie. Every poll in Nebraska said the majority of the people were clearly in favor of the public option, a government-run program that competes with private insurance. I listen to you, and all of a sudden he's in a sweater. He's hanging out, eating Christmas cookies. That's not how I see him in Washington. He's got the soft music behind him. Ding, 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 ding. Doesn't Ben Nelson look like your friendly uncle? Not when he was crushing health care reform. Not when he was preventing a strong version of it. Not while he was delaying and delaying. And look at that. They ran out of time. Now all of a sudden they lost their 60th vote. Ben Nelson's as happy as he can be that he was part and parcel of killing health care reform. And then he has the nerve at the end to say that he was for reducing the deficit. The public option would have reduced the deficit by hundreds of billions of dollars. And he killed it. Now, you can't do it, man. I mean, look, people are going to get upset about this. And said, I don't care who gets upset. The Democrats are not my uncle. If I would never give to the DNC now. When Howard Dean was running the DNC, and they were doing smart things, and they were winning, and they were pushing the right priorities. Now, later, they didn't really do them, but when Dean was in charge, they were at least pushing them. Okay, giving the DNC makes sense. Now they have a corporatist, you know, handpicked by Obama, as the head of the DNC, and they take all the money and funnel it to the worst Democrats. Please don't lecture me about, oh, they're in the tightest races and they're in the reddest states. They don't do what the people of Nebraska ask, that we have the polls. I understand that, okay? And they funnel it to these guys to run Republican ads. No, hell no. Not going to give money to that. All right, so now here's another Democratic great piece of politics. So, John Murtha is a guy who, you know, did a great job in coming out against the Iraq War, you know, during the Bush administration. Got a lot of credit for that and should. But everybody knew that John Murtha is in the back pocket of the defense contractors. And even at the time, as we said, hey, listen, Jack Murtha's right on this, but be cautious of Murtha. And then there was the ethical allegations, et cetera, right, on whether he had his ethics right. I mean, he's funneled so much money to corporations inside his own district, which you could say is politics as usual, and he's funneled so much money, that totally wasted garbage money, to defense contractors. Anyway, so he proposes to put the Haitian relief into the defense bill so that it can get passed right away and the Haitians could get the money right away, the relief organization. And for a second, I let my guard down. And I was like, oh, isn't that great? That's good. I wonder why he cares so much about that, but good. Dummy. You know why he put it in the defense bill? Because the defense bill authorizes the funding for not only the continued wars and the escalation of the wars, but also has all that new money for defense contractors, some of which the Defense Department doesn't even want to spend. But the congressman put it in there as pork barrel spending. Gates is trying to kill one of the top programs in the Defense Department because it doesn't work, and we've wasted billions upon billions of dollars on it, but those congressmen and senators get paid by those companies. So, in order to protect those contracts, he inserts Haitian relief in there so that he can turn around and go, are you going to vote against Haitian relief? Is that what you're going to do? How dare you? That's politics. Okay? So you think the Democrats are on your side? You think they're on the Haitian side? No. In this case, I mean, Jesus, do they have a soul? Using the Haitians as a cover to funnel more money to the defense contractors that paid them off. Welcome to America, Young Turks.
I remember how it all began. I used to sing dirty raps to my East Side fans back then. I knew you couldn't stop.
All right, back on TYT. Two members to thank here. Member number 1727, Stephen Watson, joined up on June 29th of 2009. And then member number 2088, more recent, Neil Friedman, joined up on September 14th of 2009. Neil, thank you. It's elementary, my Watson. La, 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 la. Silly. Okay. In today's postgame show, which will be immediately following this fine program, for the members only, we will be talking about lib funerals, okay, how you can get buried in a green way, and we'll do the salad story, how there's shit all over your salad.
Yeah, that's quite, pretty much the story.
Quite literally, okay, but we'll break down the details for you so yes. You can get grossed out and never eat salad again. Okay, let's move forward.
All right, we have a very disturbing video that features a 12-year-old bullfighter from Mexico, and he's in Colombia, he is competing in bullfighting, and he gets hurt.
He all right. He gets seriously hurt. So you're allowed to laugh at this. Because I'm a bad man.
I can't believe you laughed at this.
Oh, come on. How do you not laugh at this? All right, let's watch this.
12-year-old Michelito, a young Mexican matador, got more than he bargained for when he stepped into the bullfighting ring Sunday.
What's that? That's so funny.
Spectators watched in horror. A bull knocked him to the ground and then gored him before his father and other matadors rushed in to rescue him. A short time later, Michelito went back into the ring and the same thing happened again. This time, his father was knocked to the ground and then gored as well. Still, Michelito finished the show. Afterward, he was taken to a hospital for an X-ray. Luckily, doctors
found no major injury. Get out of there!
Washington, the associated.
I can't believe that he got attacked twice.
And almost a third time.
Yeah, and he still went out there and continued competing, and then he went to the hospital.
All right.
Little Michelito.
All right, I want to clarify a couple of things here. First of all, when he got thrown the first time, I wasn't laughing, okay, when I watched the first time. Mm-hmm. But then when he got thrown the second time, I was like, come on, Michelito, get out of there, okay? And then when he started running around the third time, he's like, what's the kid, why did I come back out of here? This is such a bad idea. I'm like, get him out of there, man, come on. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's why I was laughing, and I know already that he was fine. I read it before I saw the video, right? Now, having said that, I mean, I love that the bull got a little revenge. I love that every time he does it.
Right.
I mean, who did you notice the bull with, like, the 18 spears hanging out his back?
Yeah.
Who's crying for him, right? And, but, look, don't get me wrong. I don't like the bullfighting. I think it's ridiculous, et cetera. I'm glad the dad got them. Okay. But you got to give Michelito a lot of credit, man.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, that's definitely a tough 12-year-old, man. You think that 12-year-old, most 12-year-olds come out for a second beating after they get gored by a bull? That's one tough little kid, man. I mean, and if you're the dad, if you're the mom, you're like, you did what? You sent him out again?
Mm-hmm.
You know he's 12? Okay. Oh, that dad's going to be in a world of trouble when he gets home.
I'm sorry. That's the line that I go with, man. If you go out there and you get it the first time, I'm like, oh, man, that's kind of messed up 12-year-old. Probably got talked into this. And you go back out there, that's when I start rooting for the bull to fuck you up worse. That's just all there is. I mean, the next time I was like, well, now it's your fault. You know, fool me once. You know, you keep going back out there. Now you're asking for it. You know it can happen. Maybe the first time you get, oh, it's never happened to me. I'm so good at this. I've never gotten hit before. You get it, man. You should stop. If people go if you go up in the mountains and there's a sign that says danger, mountain lions are around here all times, and you say, let's set up tent right here. I'm going to say, well, you deserve to get your ass eaten up then. Fine, do whatever. That's your choice. You know what you're eating yourself into.
When the bull starts trampling him, I get like, I don't like that. That scares me, right? But when he flips him, let's be honest, it's a little funny. Okay, now here comes the second one.
There's an old saying in Tennessee. I know it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee, that says, fool me once, shame on you. If fool me, we can't get fooled again.
Michelino, you should listen to Bush. Oh, when he drops that thing on the third time around and he starts booking it, that's my favorite part, man. He's like, fuck this, man. What was I doing listening to fucking Dad? Oh, no, yeah, go back out there again. All right. That was awesome. All right. Yeah. Now, yes. Serious story about absence.
Yes. Rob Stein from the Washington Post has written an article about a study that has to do with abstinence-only education and how it might be a very effective form of sex education,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, in the past, there have been no studies that indicate this, right? So conservatives are looking at this study and saying, yes, we got them, right? Abstinence-only education is effective, and we have a study that proves it. Except this study doesn't prove shit.
Oh, damn.
Okay. Now, let me tell you what the findings of the study were, okay? It says that only about a third of 6th and 7th graders who completed an abstinence-focused program started having sex within the next 2 years. Nearly half of the students who attended other classes, including ones that combined information about abstinence and contraception, became sexually active.
Okay.
Okay, so basically, those who took the abstinence-focused courses were less likely to engage in sex in the next 2 years, and those who took comprehensive sex education were more likely to engage in sex in the next 2 years. Now, the reason why this study doesn't prove anything is because the abstinence-focused education or curriculum wasn't really abstinence-only. And what I mean by that is it was a very moderate form of sex education. First of all, what it did is it didn't give any moral standards. Yeah, moral standards when it came to having sex. Basically, the abstinence-focused curriculum said, you know, you don't have to wait till marriage to have sex. Just wait for the time that's right for you, right? Which is super moderate. That's not abstinence-only. Come on. And also, the abstinence-only curriculum did not disparage condom use.
Right. So it wasn't, first of all, let's get this clear. It wasn't abstinence only. I don't know why they keep calling it that. It was abstinence focused.
Right.
It talked about condoms. So if you're going to do safe sex discussion and then tell kids not to have sex until they're ready, yeah, I'm in. I think that's exactly right.
And that's pretty
so
much.
So am I surprised that that worked? I don't question the numbers. Mm-hmm. I think the numbers are right. I think it's a legitimate study, right? Mm-hmm. Now, you can argue about some of the specifics, but overall, I think, yeah, okay, that makes sense. But when you listen to what was in the program, there was no moralizing, as
right.
Anna said. There was no, it didn't say wait till you're married. It said wait till you're ready, right? And it gave kids a little bit of maturity mm-hmm. about how to handle sex, which is what I would do as a parent.
Right.
So if they came to me with an abstinence-only program for my kids in my school, And they lectured him about how you know, it's dirty sex and condoms never work and you should wait till you're married. Mm-hmm. I'd say, get out of here. That's nuts. I would never agree to that, right? But if they come and say, hey, you know, condoms work and you should only have sex when you're ready, I'm like, yeah, all right, where do I sign?
Right.
As a parent, that's what I would want. That makes sense.
And basically, this abstinence-focused education, the way they're labeling it, it's comprehensive sex ed, right? To a lesser extent. But it is. It's comprehensive sex ed. Don't have sex until you're ready for it. And when you do decide to have sex, make sure you protect yourself with condoms. That's comprehensive sex education.
I have another word for it, which is, of course! It's of course sex education. So, Tom, regulate for us. Did you have problems with the numbers, or is that, do you have a different issue with it?
No, I had a couple of issues, one of which you touched on, which I'll get to and expand on a little bit. But the first one was I had an issue with the age of the kids that they used in the study, because they used 6th and 7th graders. And on average, that means that the kids are 11 to 13 years old. Now, the thing to keep into account is they followed them, or they got back with them after 2 years. So you're talking about kids that are 13 to 14 or 15 years old, basically, like getting back to them and saying, okay, have you had sex? Did you use contraception? That sort of thing. Now, the thing is, if you look at a variety of sources, you'll see that in the U.S., the average age that someone loses their virginity is 16 years old.
Okay. Right.
So that would be
for
like
boys. For girls, it's 17 years old, and that's today. Back in the day, it used to be 19, right? But for younger people, it's now 16 and 17. So most kids haven't even lost their virginity by the time this study gets back to them.
Right. So an analogy that I would think of for this study, it would be like doing a study on how good a retirement plan works and following up with people when they turn 64, when the vast majority of people retire when they're 65. You know, a certain percentage of people, yeah, before
right.
65.
But let me do a counterpoint on that, Tom. That's a very good point, very important point. And then we know that other studies show that eventually everybody has sex before they get married, right? Or almost everybody, right? Mm-hmm. So now, no matter what pledge or what program that they went through. Now, having said that, if this program, Tom, delays kids from having sex for a little while and they have sex at 15 rather than 13 or 17 rather than 15, I think as a parent, I'm pretty happy with that. I call that a success. You see what I'm saying by that? I don't expect them to not have sex until they're 28. I'm hoping they can make it to 18.
Right. Well, I think the problem, and it's a well-made point. I think the issue with this is what a lot of people on the religious right and people who have an agenda that's tied to, religion or moral teachings are trying to make out of the study. Because if you look at the blogs today, if you look on the internet, they're going crazy. They're doing touchdown end zone dances, dancing in the streets. They're over the top about it. They're saying, oh, this is such a huge blow to so-called comprehensive sex education and all of this stuff. But
now that's a great point. Let me just jump in with it to buttress that, because one, they're going to absolutely twist this right away. They're going to call it abstinence only. They're going to say, you see that? Jesus saves, whatever. And they're going to go back to wasting a lot of money on garbage programs.
Right.
That's why we're a little scared. I don't mind the study itself. I'm scared about how it's going to get twisted, right? Because facts are facts. But unfortunately, not for the right wing. And my problem is the mainstream media is already helping them.
Right.
Like Washington Post, right in the title, abstinence-only programs might work, study says. That's
yes.
not what the study said.
That's true. Look, and the reason why this is a problem is because the Obama administration has decided to cut out all funding for abstinence-only education, okay? Obama has finally done something right, and he said, I am not going to fund any type of sex ed curriculum unless there are studies proving that the curriculum is effective, right? Now, conservatives can come to Obama, and they can come to the administration and say, look at this study. Abstinence-focused education works, but they'll twist it. They'll twist it in a way that sounds like abstinence-only education works. And then our money, our tax dollars, are going to go toward these ineffective programs.
Now, having said that, their initial reaction of the Department of Education was, if this study worked, then we would be interested in doing this kind of, we might do funding behind this, which is reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And if you call that a compromise, hey, you know, between complete comprehensive sex education and abstinence-only, and the compromise is abstinent focused, and you have a study showing it works, well, that's the kind of compromise I could live with. That makes sense to me, as long as they don't go to that extra step
right.
that the conservatives want them to.
So, yeah, it's really important to point out that a lot of previous research, for example, in the journal Pediatrics, are fairly recent, within the last year or two, I want to say, study on abstinence pledges, you know, where people say they pledge, I'm not going to have sex until I get married. Was a disaster, that the people involved in that, the kids, didn't wait any longer to have sex, and when they ultimately did have sex, they were much less likely to use birth control,
mm-hmm.
which obviously can lead to unintended pregnancy, and that can lead to abortion, which nobody wants, especially the religious right, but nobody wants that. Even pro-choice people obviously don't want that. So my biggest fear, just to reiterate what you guys were saying, is they're going to take, you know, disproven forms of abstinence, basically real abstinence only, that has the moralistic tone, that has the wait until marriage, that has another factor is a lot of times they have misinformation on contraceptives. Like they spread lies about STDs or about the ability of condoms to stop STDs or pregnancy. That's another thing. And so that's a totally different type of program than what was discussed here. And that's critical for the media to explain that very clearly.
And, of course, they won't. So that's where the problem's going to lie, okay? But that's why we're here, straightening shit out. You know that? All right. Now, I'm going to add two more stories to the post game. I want to do the dirty, dirty banker who got caught with the pictures, okay?
We like dirty, dirty. It'll be fun.
Right. And we like to bust bankers, so it's perfect. And then I'm going to put the Warlock in there.
Okay.
Warlock in the post game show for members only. We'll see you there.
Hey, this is Cenk Uygur, host of the Young Turks. Thanks for listening to our daily podcast, which is a small part of our show. You can hear the whole show by visiting theyoungturks.com. That's theyoungturks.com, where you can become a member and podcast the whole show anytime you like. And if you like what you hear, you can help spread word of the show by ranking us in the iTunes Store, Dig, and Podcast Alley. Would we appreciate that? Of course!